This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On House Bill 2, the saga continues. This week, Governor McCrory issues Executive Order 93 in response to fallout from HB 2 and, in his words, to protect the privacy and equality of all North Carolinians. But what does the move really accomplish? Meanwhile, the governor has also issued his budget priorities. CMS gives us a peek at what they're thinking with regard to pupil assignment. They're also asking for a $23 million increase in funding from the county, but the county has other ideas. And an old wound opens as the FBI releases video and audio recordings of the Patrick Cannon sting, those and other stories, on our weekly local news roundup this hour. WFAE's Tom Bullock is here, along with Nick Oxner, reporter for WBTV News. Welcome back to the program.
Good morning.
And Eric Frazier is here, editorial writer for the Charlotte Observer in our Spirit Square studio. Good morning to you,
sir. Good morning.
The governor issued, as I just said, Executive Order 93 this week in response to fallout from House Bill 2.
You know, after listening to people's feedback during the past several weeks on this issue, I have come to the conclusion that there's a great deal of misinformation, misinterpretation, confusion, passion, and frankly, selective outrage and hypocrisy, especially against the great state of North Carolina. But based on this feedback, I am taking action to affirm the state's commitment to privacy and equality. To that end, today I have signed an executive order with the goal of achieving that fine balance.
So, was this a surprise, the issuance of this order, and do we know what pushed him to do it?
Well, I don't think it was a surprise that he tried to do something to walk it back some, because I think all the pressure that's been brought to bear from companies, especially PayPal's announcement, that's 400 really well-paying jobs, the type of company that we're trying to attract, high-tech, growing industry, that leaves a mark when a company like that pulls out. So he had to do something, and I think I would have really loved to have been a fly on the wall in the debates that probably went on between him and Phil Berger and Tim Moore about what do we do to handle the fallout from this thing. And I'm picturing in my mind Phil Berger saying, basically, well, we're not doing anything. You can issue some executive order if you want and, you know, kind of cover your butt for the general election, but so we're not doing anything. So he did what he could do.
So you think the parameters of what he said, the words that he used, were crafted as a collaborative effort between him and the legislature?
Yeah.
And look how quickly Phil Berger came out with a statement of support. And you notice, I mean, the legislature has pretty much publicly said we're not going to do anything. Mm-hmm. We're not going to make any changes.
Yeah.
But it's interesting that, you know, if you look at the executive order and the action that it takes, it really does one thing. It adds two classes of people to the state's non-discrimination policy and then asks the legislature to consider doing something. And that really doesn't do anything other than just putting McCrory on record as sort of disagreeing with one part of the bill.
And it sort of adds some, possibly, state workers to – it gives them those protections that you're talking about, specifically, you know, sexual orientation and gender identity. I mean, you know, one of the points that we've tried to stress in our coverage of this is an executive order by a governor is exactly the same as an executive order of the president. It only directly affects those people under the executive branch. So this is not – a full-on, across-the-board expansion of any state policy. This is specifically targeted to certain folks. And, you know, I want to go back a little bit about why it is now. And I think Eric's really onto something. And it's not a surprise when it comes to the election side of this. I mean, that recording that you played of Pat McCrory, I mean, it itself, I think, is symbolic as to the timing. He talks about the misinformation. He talks about the hypocrisy. He talks about how, you know, he's listening to people, but there's a lot of misinformation out there. It was a strange, really strange but very telling series of words. And then he comes out with his executive order. And the reality of it is the first three main tenets they point to in their press release, and it's even more confusing when you read the actual text of the executive order, but the first three tenets do absolutely nothing but reinforce House Bill 2 word for word.
Yes, it says, Executive Order 93 does the following. Maintains common sense, gender-specific restrooms and locker room facilities in government buildings and schools. Affirms the private sector's right to establish its own restroom and locker room policies. And affirms the private sector and local government's right to establish non-discrimination employment policies for its own employees. But one of the sticky wickets here is that it takes away the abilities of municipalities to do the same thing.
It allows them to do it for their own workers, but it does not for their, you know, municipal employees, but not for workers writ large.
Right.
And, you know, ask yourself this. What's the point of an executive order that simply reaffirms a bill that is law? What is the point of saying in a statement that this is full, that the information that's being put out there is full of hypocrisy and misinformation? He is walking a line here between trying to satisfy a base and trying to come across as a moderate, a bit of a walk back, walk towards center candidate.
But does anybody see it for anything other than what you're saying it is?
Well, the reaction has, you know, overwhelmingly been no. Most people see it as, you know, a politician in an election year finding himself in a bad position, trying to sort of ameliorate the damage.
And some have said, and I think it may have been a News and Observer reporter, that his executive order also puts Roy Cooper in an uncomfortable position because it gives him less of a leg to stand on for not defending the
That was actually put out by the North Carolina Republican Party in a press release. Right. It was accredited to Dallas Woodhouse directly, I believe. And in reality, it's an interesting spin, but it's still spin. And you can argue whether or not Roy Cooper should or should not do his job. And in fairness, defending the laws of the state are part of that job. Now, as any position, you can say this is inherently wrong, and I will walk away from it. There are two sides to that argument. But saying the executive order in any way mitigates the decision that Roy Cooper made ignores the fact that Roy Cooper's stance has to do with what are – and I know this gets in a little bit of the weeds here, but it's an important point – has to do specifically with his belief about the bill, but also in particular – the non-discrimination protections that were granted to the treasurer's office and to the attorney general's office. Those two offices have elected heads. They are, you know, in the Council of State. They are not in the executive branch. So McCrory's executive action does not affect them and thus does not actually change legally Roy Cooper's statement.
No, but what it does is say that McCrory essentially now agrees with Roy Cooper in terms of who should and should not be included in a non-discrimination policy.
Yeah, and one of the things I have yet to hear the governor say, and I'm still curious about, is if it is so important, if it is so obvious that these protections should be granted to a subset of state employees, then why should those state employees get preferential treatment or differential treatment than North Carolinians across the board?
Yeah.
And
I think it does leave him open to that question.
Well, and the other
isn't that the Republican mantra that you leave the private sector's decisions to the private sector?
Unless they disagree with it and then they pass a law telling you can't.
Right.
That's Nick Ochsner, by the way. Does this executive order do what it says he intended to do to achieve the fine balance between a commitment to privacy and equality? Those are the governor's words.
I think that's an interpretation that's up to individuals.
And I think that it's telling when you look at the very first line of the executive order, the first whereas clause, or are many of them. It starts by talking about North Carolina's rich – I'm quoting here – rich legacy of inclusiveness, diversity, and hospitality, making North Carolina a global destination for jobs, business, tourists, and talent. Gee, I wonder what the impetus behind this executive order was.
So is this a precursor to what might happen when the legislature comes into session? Are they going to take another look at this and modify the
– Well, you would think they will have to address the question that McCrory asks in effectively asks in this resolution about restoring the right to sue on state claims in state court for discrimination. The rest of it, it's an open question whether they'll do anything about the actual what's at the center of this, the bathroom issue. It's kind of hard to see them backing away from that.
I hope we do get into the suing in state court clause because it's very interesting. But here's the thing. You know, Nick rightly brought up the fact that Senator Pro Tem Phil Berger almost immediately came out with a response saying, hey, this – I think the exact wording was something along the lines of – this takes away the radical left's ability to question the purpose of this bill. But what he never said, ever, and nor has Tim Moore spoken on this, as far as I know, that they are going to indeed consider the governor's call to repeal that legislation.
And after the after all the feel-good statements were put out, I asked lots of legislative Republicans, including Phil Berger's folks, hey, are you guys going to consider this? And I can't get an answer from literally anybody.
Well, that's telling.
That being said, yeah. Before this executive order, I'd had folks in Raleigh telling me that they thought it was likely that the legislature would address this. But it's interesting, right? So McCrory adds two classes of people to some state orders. Workers, but they still don't have any rights to go seek relief in state court still. So, you know, that we haven't actually addressed the underlying problem. And I think that whole issue really is what has everyone stirred up about House Bill 2. I mean, the bathroom's a hot button issue, but I think a lot of the opposition is over the non-discrimination claim and the state court access.
In his statement on Executive Order 93, he said, the governor said, we are a state that strives to allow our people and businesses to be as independent as possible without overreaching government regulation. Simply put, this government overreach was a solution in search of a problem. He's referring to the Charlotte ordinance there being overreach, a solution in search of a problem. But isn't he maneuvering himself into a corner given that the bill that the legislature passed is considered by many to be overreach?
And even by classic Republican doctrine. I mean, you know, Nick and I were talking about President Ronald Reagan before the show began, and it's fascinating to me because Reagan, who is held up as this model, this great icon of Republican and conservatism, this person who literally is seen as a benchmark in many ways, is the one who first really came up with the tenet that local control is always best. Now, granted, at the time, he was talking about state or local control and that Washington, as the capital, was the enemy. But when you think about a Republican-dominated legislature and a Republican governor who suddenly love to talk about, you know, Reagan and the local control tenets, but suddenly decide to strip away many, many municipal, you know, responsibilities or abilities, I would say, in a single piece of legislation passed in a 12-hour period, it seems to run contrary to party doctrine to me.
Yeah, and it really does. This whole thing has made me think about home rule, the old concept of home rule, and how in many states, you know, the legislature does not try to tell local, you know, municipalities what to do. They sort of presume that they know what's best for their communities. And that has not been the case in North Carolina. And I think it may be, this may be, you know, sort of a window on maybe reopening that discussion about home rule, because it's clear that there are what Charlotte and the urban areas of North Carolina need and what the playing field that they are playing on is entirely different than you know, Rockingham or Rocky Mount or places like that. And you got legislators from those places who are telling Charlotte how they should and shouldn't behave, and they have no idea what Charlotte really needs.
And I'll go a step further. I just use Reagan as an example. Let's make it more tangible and more present day, right? Let's think about all the debate over Common Core standards in education. So what has the argument been against Common Core?
Local control.
That we should make sure that all of these decisions are made by who? The local school board.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that is education policy, and clear correlation between a local school board is the local city, you know, government or county government or town government, whatever it is. So it's just what's interesting to me is this choice. I like local control when it serves what we like. I don't like it when it doesn't. And both sides do this.
Both political sides do this.
When we come back, I want to bring up a question that Lisa in Salisbury asks, because we let people comment on this as we go through the hour. And she has a very interesting point about something we've never talked about, I don't believe, with regard to HB2. We'll do that when we come back with Tom Bullock, Nick Ochsner, and Eric Fraser at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members in Mecklenburg County Solid Waste. Through curbside recycling of plastics, paper, boxes, and cans, the community saves money, energy, and resources. Together, we can wipe out waste. WipeOutWaste.com. Trade policy has surfaced from time to time in this presidential race, you may have noticed, but the candidates have generated more heat than light on the issue, with Donald Trump threatening to get tough on China and Bernie Sanders blaming NAFTA for putting a squeeze on the middle class. But the impact of free trade isn't so clear-cut. And recent surveys show that most Americans support it. So on Monday at 9, Tom Bullock will host a conversation on this program with a pair of local economists to help sort out free trade and take a look at a North Carolina industry whose decline has been blamed on free trade, that of textiles. It's a cooperative effort with NPR, and that will be on this program Monday at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the Friday News Roundup. Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton debate in Brooklyn. Paul Ryan insists he won't accept the GOP presidential nomination. And a task force says the Chicago Police Department is plagued by racism.
The News Roundup continues with the Diane Rehm Show coming up in about 20 minutes at 10 o'clock. Here on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins, along with WFAE's Tom Bullock, Nick Oxner from WBTV News, and Eric Frazier, editorial writer for the Charlotte Observer. You're welcome to comment on the stories that we're talking about at charlottetalks@wfae.org or through Facebook or Twitter. Lisa in Salisbury writes, "How come no one talks about the other aspects of this bill as it pertains to not allowing communities to raise the minimum wage? What about the overreach there? Meanwhile, Republican candidates air advertising about how they will put more power back into the local communities. Why aren't you calling them out on that?"
I think we are calling them out on that.
Just not specifically in the minimum wage, which is a fair point.
No, and actually the minimum wage, we've reported on it a bit, and she's right. It's not getting the level of attention that it really could and may, frankly, should get. But that's because there are other fights going on. I'm sure that everybody will tune to this a little bit more. But, I just did a national story on this for NPR, and that's a point we all wanted to get in there because it hasn't gotten the same level of attention. But here's the conundrum on the minimum wage issue. I've heard very divergent views on whether or not a municipality had the actual ability to raise that minimum wage. Some say yes, kind of. Some say absolutely not. The wording in the bill is in the form, I think it's fair to say, of a clarification. But either way, the effect is there. It does, in fact, say, nope, no, don't even think about it. There is no wiggle room. So the minimum wage in North Carolina cannot be higher than the $7.25 an hour that's mandated federally.
But also think about it. When you look at all the things that we just talked about, states taking away the powers from the cities, is setting a minimum wage really a power that most cities think they have to begin with?
I would actually argue, yeah.
Well, and that, I'm just asking the question. Yeah, I don't have one way or the other.
I mean, if you look at New York, Seattle, Los Angeles, San Jose, these are just a few off the top of my head. Even in presidential politics, minimum wage and how it's being done is very interesting. And you look at a state like New York, which is obviously in the news right now, especially politically because of the primary on Tuesday, they are indeed phasing in a minimum wage that's set up in a way that it makes sense for cities but does not, harm or hurt the economies of rural areas, because if you do it across the board, it would indeed hurt them. Yeah. So in New York City, you'll have a higher minimum wage than you would say in the rural areas, or the rural areas will phase it in, mm-hmm. basically.
It costs more to live in a big city than it does in the rural area.
Yeah.
The state has been criticized since the passage of HB 2 for enacting legislation that allows discrimination against gays, lesbian, transgender people. But the governor's office is bragging that because of his executive order, North Carolina is now one of 24 states that have protections for sexual orientation and gender identity for its employees. Does that balance the equation?
Well, no. I mean, and for a lot of the reasons that you were talking about earlier, it's very limited. It's, only for certain employees, state employees, the ones who are directly under the governor's control. It leaves all these other folks out. And when you put that on the scale next to what all the rest of HB 2 does, those scales don't balance.
It also begs the question, why does the governor, if these protections are not necessary and private corporations have the ability to do as they like, why would the governor or why would anyone feel the need to compare themselves to 24 other states that have those protections on the books? It just seems It seems contrary to me.
Well, it's because of the fallout. So let's talk about the fallout. Aside from the major corporations and corporate executives, and there's some, what, 350 or so executives who have signed protest letters that came out initially against House Bill 2, and aside from PayPal's decision to not bring 400 jobs to the state and Deutsche Bank's putting on hold plans to expand by 250 jobs in Cary, what are we learning about the fallout from the passage of this bill? What else is happening? Do we know of concrete examples of things not coming here, not happening here because of this?
Well, we do know of a lot of different things, but part of it is we can't really know because a lot of these decisions are being made in boardrooms and with economic development recruiters, and we'll be crossed off of lists before we even knew we were in consideration just because companies don't want to deal with the headache of all this swirl of publicity. And when you've got a company like PayPal putting down the marker that they've put down and saying we're not going to bring those 400 jobs to North Carolina because this is contrary to our corporate values, companies that then are coming behind that and considering coming to North Carolina, they're going to have employees who are asking them, well, are we less concerned about these type issues than a company like PayPal? What are we saying here?
Yeah. And, you know, there's all sorts of things that are going on that are difficult to measure. You have conventions that are saying no thanks. Right. You have conventions that are saying we may say no thanks. You're having
– and that backs up for years because these conventions are planned out years in advance. So may say no now to something that's scheduled for 2020.
Yeah.
I mean, we've already Charlotte alone has lost thousands of room nights in hotels, which equates to a lot of money.
Right.
And what's more telling, too, is you're starting to see this in Raleigh, mm-hmm. in Durham. I mean, you know, you're starting to see it in other places because if it was just hitting Charlotte, mm-hmm. then frankly, I don't think that the state legislature would mind all that much. Because I don't mean that in a cynical way. It's actually a practical and responsible way for the politicians because, let's face it, there are only so many lawmakers who reside in Charlotte or represent Charlotte or Mecklenburg County. Mm-hmm. Right. The vast majority don't.
Well, for instance, I don't know what the economic impact of a concert is, a sold-out concert in a coliseum, but Greensboro lost a Bruce Springsteen. Ringo Starr has canceled a concert. Mm-hmm. Do people go see Ringo Starr? Broadway composer Stephen Schwartz has pulled all of the rights to perform all of his musicals at every level from grade school to the Broadway series, and that includes shows like Wicked and Godspell and Pippin. But Jimmy Buffett has decided that wasting away is okay in the North State, Old North State. He's coming. These things get headlines, but do they have any lasting impact or even immediate impact?
I think they do because I think they're damaging the state's brand, you know, and rightly or wrongly, we are in an age where branding means something, even for a state. When you're in competition for jobs and you're in competition for talent, people, you know, companies that are here want people to move from other states to work for them. And I mean, this has damaged the state.
And we're in the midst here of what is essentially a PR war in many ways. And that represents, you know, for both sides of this issue. Mm-hmm. So if these people continually do things like this, just to bring it up, I mean, you know, is North Carolina's economy going to be irreparably harmed by Bruce Springsteen not performing here? Obviously, no. But it keeps attention. It stays in the headlines. Right now, as the show is live, it's almost 9:30 in the morning, the NBA owners are meeting in New York, and they are going to discuss or expected to discuss whether or not to keep the All-Star game here in Charlotte.
Well,
that's
$100 million.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Estimated. I mean, you can argue whether or not that's real.
And it's trickle down. It's not just the Coliseum here that's getting the money. It's restaurants and hotel nights and rental cars and airline flights.
But it's also PR for the city. I mean,
yeah.
Look, before living here, my wife and I lived in Baltimore. And I'll tell you.
I'm sorry.
No, I loved it. Loved it. Loved it. We'll talk about that off air, Mike.
It's 9:30 in Charlotte, 9:20 in Baltimore.
We absolutely the city loved the fact that whenever there was a big game, whether you know it was baseball or football, that you saw these incredibly beautiful shots of the Inner Harbor. Think about what it meant for Charlotte to have all those televised, wonderful shots of our skyline during the Democratic National Convention,
right.
or playoff games.
Yeah, the Carolina Panthers game.
What it comes down to is it's a loss of PR. It's a loss of outreach. You know, in a weird way, this isn't about just dollars. It's an ambassador role for the city. When it's pulled, that ambassador role is still used, but it's in reverse.
Well, and look at the money that someone is having to spend starting this week on the new campaign, the Always Welcome campaign that's going up in hotels and the Visitors Convention has launched. I mean, that's an aggressive PR campaign that they're going to have to go out and spend money and resources on just to convince folks that we're a town that wants you to come here. You know, that they didn't have to do 3 weeks ago.
Yeah.
Yeah. I want to apologize to Baltimore because I grew up in the Washington area, and that's just an old rivalry. That's just, it just came through.
We're still going to have words after.
The feelings are raw on the studio.
I couldn't suppress it. Getting back to the NBA All-Star Game, Atlanta, as we talked about last week and I believe the week before, has been actively campaigning for the game to be – this All-Star Game to be transferred from Charlotte in 2017 to that city. And six United States senators – have asked the league to move the game. And I think this was in a letter to the editor, to the Observer. Someone pointed out this puts the NBA in a pretty awkward position because they have teams in states with similar laws. Are they supposed to pull their teams from those cities?
And actually, my colleague on the editorial board, Peter St. Ange, has written a really good column about this whole question about, are some of the boycotters, the boycotting companies and institutions, can they legitimately be accused of hypocrisy in some ways in that they're, you know, sort of holding North Carolina to one standard and they are doing business in other states that they're not holding to that standard? And you can make that argument, but as Peter says in his column, these types of situations are sort of like people themselves in terms of boycotts, and you know they're not going to be uniformly, 100% applied the same way in every, in every instance, because we as people are inconsistent, and sometimes it's just something happens and it happens in such a spectacular form that it catches our attention and we want to place a flag or a marker right there. And unfortunately for North Carolina, HB2 was done in such an aggressive, overreaching, all-encompassing way that it attracted a lot of attention. And people have decided, rightly or wrongly, that they are going to plant a flag and fight it right there, maybe more aggressively than they are in other states.
So the NBA is meeting.
That's just what it is.
They're meeting right now. Do we know what the criteria they will use to talk about this? What talking points they may use internally? Who makes the final decision about whether or not they pull the game in 2017? We have no idea.
I think that's just the thing. No one knows except, I guess, what the NBA owners who are in the room making that decision. Mm-hmm. And just like PayPal, just like Deutsche Bank, just like the conventions, it's really a subjective standard.
Michael Jordan. Yeah. One of those owners.
That's who I immediately think of.
And he's a god in the basketball world.
So. You would hope that Michael Jordan speaks out on Charlotte's behalf and that, because on the one hand, you would hate to see Charlotte lose something of that magnitude. On the other hand, you have, this principle. Right. Of fighting something that is widely seen as unjust, HB2. So we'll see. I guess we'll see later today what happens.
Despite having to take time out to issue Executive Order 93, the governor also had time this week to issue his proposed budget. He wants to increase spending on substance use disorders, on Medicaid, and pre-kindergarten. Any surprises by those three items that he's focusing on?
Well, and last week he also pitched his proposal for a 5% raise for teachers, bringing the average teacher salary up to $50,000. I think a lot of what has in his proposals that he's rolled out so far and highlighted are good things. I think it's interesting, the timing of it, obviously, and I think that this is an attempt for him to change the conversation towards budget priorities at a time when he's getting a lot of flack. But as someone who's gone to some of those press conferences announcing these good things, you ask him about HB2, I'm not sure that he's getting much traction there.
Right. Yeah, you take away HB2 and all these things are probably giving him a good sort of wind at his back towards re-election. HB2 just sort of chops up the waters for him tremendously.
Yeah, and I think all of these things are good things. You know, on the surface, it's hard to argue with them. But it is all lost. And I would even argue that the rolling out of this, it may be pushed up slightly because of the debate over House Bill 2. But in reality, this is an election year. This is also, you know, what the governor does when it comes to rolling out budget priorities. So these announcements coming, just, you know, they're there and there's some interesting ideas. Well, you can argue about whether they're big enough or whether or not it's really that much more than just, you know,
window dressing.
Yeah.
He's proposing $30 million to help people with mental illness and substance use disorders, including additional funding for treating substance use with effective medications. We talked about one earlier this week, Naloxone, I think it's called, where it's an opiate, reverses the effects of opiate addiction or overdose, just like that. And it's what many public health officials have said is absolutely essential in the fight to, against opioid addiction, which has reached epidemic proportions. And the governor also wants legislation that would make the overdose reversal drug available at pharmacies. Will this get pushback from the legislature? Are there people in the legislature who just don't understand this or who still want to fight a war on drugs as opposed to getting these people the medical help that they need?
I think it really boils down to cost and where that money is going to come from. It's difficult to see anybody, and I mean this truly, it's difficult. I can't think of a single Republican or Democrat that on its surface would not want to help or has not, you know, tried to do something in this kind of situation. The opioid epidemic is an epidemic, and there is clear understanding of that. But it, again, it comes – you're talking $30 million. It comes down to whether or, you know, where that money is going to come from. And it would be easy to see this pass or get swept aside. $30 million is nothing in a $20 billion state budget. But a budget is not defined by pocket change or big checks. It's a really tightly woven.
Yeah, $30 million here, $30 million there. It begins to add up.
Yeah. And so I think that's really where you, if you are going to see anything, it would probably come from that.
The state decided not to expand the Medicaid program to support those in the donut hole of the Affordable Care Act. These are people who make too much money to qualify for assistance to buy the insurance that they cannot afford under the Affordable Care Act. But now the governor's proposing to increase spending on Medicaid. What impact would that have on those people in the donut hole, or is this something completely separate from that, or do we know?
That's a good question. I don't know.
Okay. I think you've stumped us, but I also think it's important to go back and look at why McCrory said, you know, advocated against expanding Medicaid in the first place.
It's going to cost the state too much money after the government spent, what was it, 5 years or something, paying for all of it?
100% for 3 years, okay. 90% thereafter.
Okay. Right. I mean, because – and at the time, North Carolina Medicaid was in an uncertain position. And
that's being generous. It was in debt heavily.
Okay. Yes, to put it a little more straightforward. And now I think one could argue that they've shored up that position significantly, and so I think we're back to a point where, you know, the governor and the legislature can look at expanding some services and some coverage to people who really need it. And I think the governor is trying to make the point, look, now we can go serve these communities and folks that actually need it.
You're asking a very specific question about a very specific group of people that has yet to be addressed, frankly, by the governor and is not included in this budget proposal. What he is laying out is some expansions, yes, of smaller programs on a smaller level. I'll give you an example. He's talking about adding 320 slots in Medicaid programs for disabled adults that will allow people with Alzheimer's and older adults to stay in their homes. That's 320 North Carolinians. Now, that's good. It's going to cost $3 million, but that hardly addresses broader issues. I'll give you another example. Adding 250 slots in Medicaid program for people with developmental disabilities that allows them to live in their communities. So that's two examples. That's, what, 570 North Carolinians. That's not a huge impact.
When we come back.
It is for those individuals, but not overall.
When we come back, we have a lot to talk about with regard to CMS and the schools. We'll do that in a moment at Charlotte Talks and the Weekly News Roundup on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Blumenthal Performing Arts, presenting the Broadway musical The Bridges of Madison County, a romantic story of two people caught between decision and desire, May 3rd at Knight Theater. Tickets at blumenthalarts.org. And UNC's Department of Theater presenting As We Like It, a celebration of Shakespeare in honor of the 400th anniversary of his death, April 23rd in Robinson Hall for the Performing Arts. Details at arts.uncc.edu. Well, the weekly news roundup continues with the National Hour next. Diane Rehm and her guest will be talking about Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton's debate in Brooklyn last night. Paul Ryan insisting he will not accept the Republican presidential nomination, and a task force saying the Chicago Police Department is plagued by racism. Those stories and more, and then the International Hour follows at 11. If you'd like to join our hour, you can email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org, search for WFAE on Facebook, or reach us at charlottetalks on Twitter.
I'm Cokie Roberts. As a commentator at NPR, I try to apply my decades of reporting to today's breaking news in hopes of giving you some context and a richer understanding of our political landscape. And believe it or not, that old clunker in your driveway can help pay for that richer understanding. That's right, donating your old car can help pay for the programs you love. Here's how.
Learn more, visit WFAE.org, and click on the support tab for details.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. It's our weekly news roundup with Eric Frazier, Charlotte Observer editorial writer, Nick Oxner, investigative reporter for WBTV News, and Tom Bullock, reporter for WFAE News. Let's talk about schools. CMS Superintendent Ann Clark wrote a draft outline for student assignment changes that was presented to the board this week. And this, I think, was a surprise, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah, you dropped think. Absolutely. Yeah. They kind of – it wasn't even – Lisa Wharf, one of our reporters at WFAE told
me – Our
education reporter just was like, yeah, they just kind of dropped this in after the meeting already started. Like literally last second it was added in. It was not on the agenda ahead of the meeting.
I mean, the board was supposed to be kind of wrangling with this, but Ann Clark has done her own analysis and put this thing together, and it is said – that a lot of parents like what she came up with.
Yeah. I mean, it looks like they're trying to sort of, you know, walk that line between allowing for there to continue to be a respect and trying to make sure that people are allowed to continue to go to their neighborhood or home schools.
Right.
While at the same time leaving some sort of wiggle room to try and get some more diversity and to break up concentration
well,
of
your
poverty.
Your cartoonist, Kevin Sires, did a cartoon of Ann Clark juggling all kinds of things, including a chainsaw.
Yeah, that was pretty good.
and this is kind of what she's done here with regard to this, because this is a juggling act. It really is.
Yeah.
She's proposing students be assigned to schools close to home, mm-hmm. that family income be taken into account when drawing school boundaries, and for placing students in magnets. It suggests using magnets and opt-in schools mm-hmm. to give parents choices with priorities for socioeconomic status and for students in persistently low-performing schools.
Yeah.
A lot of that was discussed during our public conversation last week on this program at Spirit Square's McGlone Theater with two members of the school board and other folks in the audience, and Ann Clark was in attendance at that. Can you do all that? Can you juggle all these things and make it happen, really?
Yes. Honestly, it seems like it for me, from my read on this, because what's interesting is when you talk about drawing boundaries to take into consideration socioeconomic clusters, poor clusters, really, is what we're talking about, concentrations of poverty. They're very specific in the draft outline that's for new boundaries. That's not redrawing. It's for new mm-hmm. schools. And that's interesting because basically what you're saying is, all right, for all the suburbanites who are angry about this, everybody who's been going to the meetings in green shirts, we are going to make sure you get to stay with your local school, with your home school. For those who are now showing up in orange shirts,
right.
We understand where you're at. You don't want your kids to be going to poorly performing schools. Who would? So what we're going to do is give you priority to go to these magnets and opt-ins, and this kind of implied idea that if there are new school boundaries drawn for new constructed schools, that, mm-hmm. that this will be taken into account to move people around or try to get them out of – break up the concentrations of poverty. It's an interesting – it's a really interesting compromise.
Yeah, and it seems like the place where they really needed to go. I mean, it given the passions that have sort of, you know, erupted on both sides, this is kind of a down the middle pitch, you know, and that was kind of what they had to do. I actually think that given the way that Charlotte is developing right now and the fact that you've got more people coming to center city or close-in neighborhoods like Wesley Heights and Plaza Midwood and Mary Oaks, places like that, you actually have an opportunity in a lot of these places to increase diversity while respecting neighborhood schools. You just have to get more of the people who are moving into these neighborhoods, middle-class white people generally, to go to their neighborhood schools. And that's where the magnet concept comes in. But they'll need to – it's going to take money. You can't create a new magnet program just by slapping a label on it and saying, okay, now it's a magnet. Everybody come. People are going to see through that. You have to put the – you have to invest money into coordinators, preferably full-time magnet coordinators. You have to hire specially trained teachers who are, you know, experts in whatever that magnet theme is for that school. And that's, you know, that's mm-hmm. that's going to be where the devil's going to be in the details of
what,
all
was
this
how it was supposed to happen? Did we always think that Ann Clark would come up with a plan that would be a starting point for debate for the board itself? Or did she just kind of listen to things that were going on in the community? Because she was making phone calls, I'm told, about this up until the time she went to that meeting.
Well, I think...
Did she just come up with a plan and think, okay, I'll just present it?
Just from what I can tell, it seems like she did kind of wade in there and kind of... you had a board that clearly was struggling with this situation. You had one faction that was going in one direction, another faction that was saying, if you guys go in that direction, you know, we're jumping ship. It's going to be, you know, all hell's going to break loose.
Because even the people who have threatened to secede from the system are now saying, hey, this is pretty good.
Yeah. And so you kind of had to have someone come in and say, everybody calm down. Here's how we can do it. And here's how we can sort of, you know, mix the best of both of these approaches and not, you know, blow up the whole thing.
So if she is if her plan, by and large, is passed by the board and everybody likes the plan, what does that say about passing over her years ago for superintendent? She seems to have a handle on things.
Well, you could argue that this is kind of a plan and a compromise that one can only reach if you think you're not going to be the permanent superintendent forever. I mean, she's in kind of a good position from being, hey, I'm the quote-unquote interim, although she's been here a long time for an interim. And, you know, she has the luxury of listening to everyone throwing ideas against the wall. And if they don't stick, well, she's not stuck with those bad decisions or bad proposals for years to come.
Okay. Meanwhile, Ann Clark and the CMS board are seeking a $23 million increase for CMS in funding. This is outside the bond request. This is just the annual budget. And the county commission, which funds the schools, is pushing back. Now, the schools tell us that they have been in cutback mode since the Great Recession. And Ann Clark says that these funds will allow the system simply to hold steady. So what's the disconnect here? Why the county commission is not, why don't they see it the school's way?
Because that's what they do.
Yeah. This is the dance that they dance every year. The schools give out one number and say, we have to have this number. And the county commissioners who are responsible for ultimately signing off on the, you know, signing the checks that fund CMS, they always say, well, we're going to lower that number because we have all these other competing. We got to deal with parks and recreation and social services. We have all these things to fund, and we can't just write you a blank check for whatever amount you say.
Speaking of checks, I read in the paper this morning. I read the paper, you know, Eric.
All right.
I read in the paper this morning.
We wish more people would.
there's a rumor about maybe floating a property tax increase to fund some of this.
There are rumors.
Interesting idea.
Yeah.
But, you know, if you're a commissioner in an election year, you do not want to talk about a property. Like, seriously talk about
exactly
a property tax increase.
And in reality, you know, didn't we hear this last year? This is the negotiation. Nick and Eric are both right. This is the negotiation process that we see on a yearly basis. Mm-hmm. Sales tax, property tax, it seems like they're always being talked about in some way, shape, or form. You know, it's rumor season. We'll have to wait to see exactly what happens a little bit later on in budget season.
So how does this usually end? The back and forth between the jockeying, who wins?
Well, usually it seems like usually what happens is they meet in the middle somewhere. Yeah. You know, it's the school board doesn't get everything that they wanted. The county commissioners wind up coming up some from where they said they'd come.
Yeah.
come in.
Meanwhile, I think the county commission is not terribly supportive of the $750 or $803 million, whatever it is, a bond package that the school system wants. And several members of the school board actually want it to be over $1 billion, but they know they're wise not to ask for that because they're not going to get it. And last week we talked about how some people are against that because they have like $223 million left on a previous bond package. But each of these bond packages, as I understand it, are issued for specific things, and you just can't move the money around because, oh, you have a new bright and shiny toy to buy.
Right, and when you're spending hundreds of millions of dollars, you have to do it in an organized, you know, and sort of coherent way, which means you don't just spend it all at once. You sort of, you know, you schedule it out over time so that you can monitor each of these many projects and make sure that each one is crossing the finish line as they're supposed to. So that's why they still have money to spend from the previous bond issue. And although I think the optics of that do make it a little weird for the school board to still be asking for, you know, new money, even though they haven't spent the old money, but I think they still make a fairly convincing case that, you know, we didn't get everything we said we actually needed back in the last bond referendum, and the needs never went anywhere, so we're still asking you for what we said we needed.
And the new bond referendum would be for new buildings and upfitting and repairing older facilities, which evidently are all that money is needed.
Yeah. I don't really doubt that they need the money. My question and the editorial board at the Observer's question is 2016 the right time to put that on the ballot when you've got all these other variables in motion? You've got the student assignment thing, a superintendent search. You've got, you know, all this stuff going on. You know, Kevin Sears' cartoon about Ann Clark, you know, juggling, like, you know, flaming chainsaws and kids and, you know, throw me the bond package too, you know. It's very apt. And we just question whether all of this can be gotten across the finish line, and maybe 2017 is a better time to do, you know, the bond package.
Speaking of the superintendent search, four firms have pitched the school board for the job, which will be to help the school system find a new superintendent. Who are those four firms, and what do they bring to the table? Do we know?
Oh, well,
search firms. You're looking at my monitor.
Oh, sorry. I was distracted.
We have news coming in here. You didn't hear the question.
Yeah. I know one of them that was in consideration as a firm that one of the former school board members, Trent Merchant, who has sort of informally advised the board on, you know, this whole process already, one of them is a firm that he used to work for. I don't know how that all figures in, but I think the firm that they select will help frame how they proceed, because a lot of these firms have very sort of specific ways that they do these things, and they don't all do it the same way, and each of them sort of come to these things with sort of a stable of, you know, sort of potential candidates that they have already in their back pocket, and they laid them out in front of the board. A lot of them will be the same, but different firms probably rate the different contenders differently. So it is an important process to figure out the right one that matches what they want to do.
Let me share with our listeners what distracted you as you looked at my monitor. The vice chair of the county commission, Dumont Clark, just emailed us. CMS, he says, is funded 2/3 by the state, 1/3 by the county. Get facts straight.
Yeah, it's a fair point.
That is correct.
And when we were talking about the budget, we should have been saying the word subsidy, which is exactly what it is.
Right.
He's got a point.
Okay. Yeah. Let's move on to the open wound, or the scab that was peeled back this week because of the release, thanks to the media, meddling media.
Darn us.
Through the Freedom of Information Act, the FBI released video and audio tapes of the sting operation that took down former Charlotte Mayor Patrick Cannon. Did we learn anything new from this, or does this merely give us a voyeuristic chance to to look into the room as he takes the bribes.
Well, I don't think we learned anything new because a lot of that was already spelled out in the complaint. But my wife, Sarah Blake Morgan, fellow reporter at WBTV, was the first one who watched these videos in Charlotte as part of the FBI Citizens Academy. And she makes the point that, you know, she wasn't here for the Patrick Cannon arrest and she didn't have a lot of context. But when she watched what's in the videos and what we've all seen now, and you see the sitting mayor taking a bribe in his office, when you actually see it on video, it just really brings home.
And you see him leafing through the paper money.
Yeah, and fanning it up by his face. I mean, it just puts a visual on something that it's hard to picture. And I mean, it looks like something out of a movie almost.
Well, you know, I remember when we were covering Patrick Cannon, and the night he resigned, we got a copy of his resignation. And the first thing that struck me is nowhere in that note did he deny the charges, say he was going to fight and win in court, he was waiting for his day in court. And you see that video, and now you know why. Yeah. It is so clear cut.
And I think it was important to see the video because there were questions about, you know, well, his supporters were saying, well, maybe they entrapped him and maybe it's not as clear cut as what we – excuse me. And the video kind of puts all that to rest.
And of course, we read in the paper and heard reporters on radio and television talking about his comment with regard to him not looking good in an orange jumpsuit.
But jumpsuit.
That's right. But now we have the actual recording.
Even something like that goes down. There I am, smiling on TV or not. And there you are, smiling on TV or not.
Right, yeah. Nobody wants that, believe me. I don't want that for you. I don't want that for me. And I've never had that situation. So
I look good in an orange necktie, but not an orange suit.
I hear you.
I should point out that the FBI's voice has been digitally altered so that we don't recognize them because they're undercover people. And that's a phone call between him and an undercover FBI agent.
And how nice is it now not to just have the FBI say, I hear you? Patrick Cannon, so do we. We all hear you. And that laugh as he's talking about this seals the deal. There's no doubt.
And he knew what he was doing is wrong. When you make the orange jumpsuit remark, when you look out the window before you fan the money up to your head, it just shows that you know what you're doing is illegal.
So because of all this frivolity about Patrick Cannon, we have not been able to talk about the Hornets going into the playoffs. They're playing Miami Miami for the first two games and then coming here next weekend. How are they going to do, Eric?
I think they are going to win at least two games.
Because even though Miami is sixth, is third seeded and we're sixth, they're actually kind of even keel.
Yeah.
Chris Bosh is still out with the blood clot, isn't he?
Yeah, he is. Yeah. We could win the series.
Yeah. All right. Well, we'll see what happens. And we'll cover it next Friday if we win the first two games on the Weekly News Roundup. Nick Oxner, Eric Frazier, Tom Bullock, thank you for the hour.